but you know them all. And I couldn't say them any better than anybody else can, I'm sure of that. But I just want to tell you that this gal is radiant. She is terrific, and I love her. This is Dottie H. from Long Beach, California.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dottie, and I'm an alcoholic. And you guys are tremendous. I just hope I can get through this without crying, because I've had a marvelous weekend. And, you know, I get kind of nervous at times thinking, jeepers, you know, what can I tell them? And, but, you know, then I remember where I am, that I'm in an AA meeting. And I know that you people allow me the privilege of goofing or doing it good or whatever. No matter what I do up here, you're going to love me. All I have to do is come in and say I'm an alcoholic, and you automatically love me. And that's fantastic, because I don't know where else in the world you could go and find this kind of a deal. But I'm just grateful to be an alcoholic. And to tell you a little bit about what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like today, I had a lot of problems in my personality and things, I think, as a child, before I started drinking. As I look back now, of course, I didn't think so then, but I was always a very sensitive child, and I was an only girl, and I had four brothers, and I was born and raised in Kansas, in Topeka, just 30 miles from where my husband was. We met here in AA, in California, but I had all these little things when I was young growing up. I was very sensitive and different things like this. And I used to think there was really something wrong with me because I was made backwards. You know, there was something wrong because whenever there was anything that was real sad or tragic or any time that I shouldn't laugh, that's when I giggled. And I was quite a giggler, as many people that knew me when I first came into AA, my nickname was Giggle. But I had this giggling problem before I found alcohol. And whenever it was anything happy, you know, like a movie, you know, the dog comes home, Lassie comes home, and the horse gets well, or, you know, whatever it was, I would cry. You know, everybody's happy, and I cry. And so I used to have this problem, and I really thought something was wrong, and I used to get in a great deal of trouble when I was in school for it, laughing. Because if I was ever bawled out for something, she may be bawling out a whole group. But I would think, oh, whatever you do, don't laugh. And then I'd start right in front of them. I'd just get hysterical. And then, of course, I'd be pulled aside. And then I'd get it double, you know, because they'd say I had no respect for authority and all these kind of things, you know. And if I was in church, I would be fine unless a nun or a priest came and sat anywhere near me. If I was in shot of them, just because they sat there, I giggled, you know. And but this was one of my problems I had. Every wedding I was in, the kids were always afraid to ask me after the first few because I stood on the altar in hysterics. And I never giggled soft. I always made noise and everything. And so it was really pretty bad. And I didn't know anything about this until I came into AA. I mean, I didn't know what the problem was. And I know when my little brother died, my youngest brother, and I was in the sixth grade, and I was close to this little brother, and I remember laughing at his funeral all the way out, just giggling hysterically. And any time anybody talked to me about this, I giggled. And I remember at the time how bad I felt. I said, God, what's the matter with me? You know, there's something wrong. And I thought, what are these people going to think of me? But, you know, I didn't know until I came into AA, and you people told me that it was the emotion, and that it was all right. In some ways it comes out in laughter or tears, but it is feeling from that same emotion. But, you know, nobody ever told me that all the time I was out there trying to cover up. And I was the type of person that I started drinking, and I didn't seem to have much trouble with drinking. I didn't drink that much and didn't seem to have any trouble, but I felt comfortable, you know, because when I drank, I wasn't quite as nervous or felt so inferior, and it kind of covered up for some of those inadequate feelings that I had. And I used to always want to impress people because I had all of these feelings. As a child, I always felt this inferiority and insecurity and all of these kind of things, And so I wanted you to like me. Man, I just was so desperate to have you people like me that I would go to any length and I would try to be what you wanted me to be. And so when I had a few drinks, it would calm me enough where I could talk, because when I would go out on a date or something, I would try to read the paper, think of something, you know, conversation, because when I got there, I couldn't think of anything. You know, I could talk all the time, but I couldn't think of anything because I wanted to be brilliant or something, what you'd want it to be, and it would never come out that way. And I know I tried many things, and I was never successful at it because I always goofed no matter what it was I was trying to impress you with. And I remember when I first came to California, I was from Kansas, like I said, and I came to California, and I'd never seen an ocean or anything, and a girlfriend of mine, fixed me up with a blind date, and it was the first time we went down I was ever on a boat, more than a rowboat, and it was a cabin cruiser type thing, and all these people were talking about boats and all these things. Well, gee, I just couldn't think of a thing to say. I didn't know anything about any of this, and finally I remembered, and I told him that my brother had a friend that had a 19-inch boat. You know, and I remember the guy looked at me, and he says, what do they do, play in the bathtub with it? But this is the way I always impressed him. When I tried to bring up something I thought I knew, it just never worked out that way. And, of course, this is when I would drink more, and so I could be a part of and feel a part of. And then I started having blackouts. But, of course, I didn't know they were called blackouts until I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it scared me when I had these, but I thought that, you know, everybody had them that drank, and it had to be something with the system or something. Because, like, another one of my sensitive things, I had a weak stomach as a child, very weak stomach. And so I got very sick when I drank. But, of course, the reason I got sick, I knew, was because of this weak stomach I had. Because when I was a kid in school and in high school, because of this, everybody knew it. So the big fun thing was to talk about unpleasant things, because they knew if they talked about anything unpleasant, I would throw up. And I did. Many times I wouldn't make it out of the lunchroom. And so because of having this, I knew that when I got sick from drinking, I didn't think it was from drinking. I knew it was this weak stomach. And so I could say, well, the reason I get sick is, you know, this, or, you know, it's the mix or the pizza or whatever it seemed to be, but it wasn't because of the drinking. But then, of course, as my drinking progressed and I got sicker, today I'm very grateful that I did get as sick as I did when I drank, because this is what I'm sure brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous when it did, because I was a periodic alcoholic. And I worked every day because I was self-supporting through my own contributions, you know. And I worked all the time. And, of course, my connotations of an alcoholic were entirely different. But many things happened to me when I drank, many things that I thought were just hilarious and funny, you know, and all of this kind of things. And I remember one time in this place, I pretended I couldn't speak English, you know, and I was from some foreign country. And, you know, all these crazy things that you look back and think, oh, you know, you just can't believe it, you know, the next morning, of these things, just praying you didn't see anybody you knew. And but like, these blackouts scared me. And, you know, the fear that you have, and I'd wake up with that, why me, you know. And, you know, because my idea, I just wanted to go and have a good time and spread joy to the world and have you people like me. That's all I wanted. And I didn't want to get drunk. So when I started having these problems of getting drunk all the time, I tried everything not to get drunk. I drank half and half before I went out. I drank olive oil before I went out. I always ate dinner before I went out on a dinner date. And I tried all of these things because I didn't want to get drunk. And I knew by this time I could never guarantee when I would get drunk and when I wouldn't. And so I tried all of these things not to get drunk. And I figured that if I ate dinner before we went out to dinner, by the time you have a few drinks and it came time to eat, well, then I could eat again. But I thought on a full stomach it wouldn't affect me. But the only thing was I was a fatter drunk, you know, because I always ate and I always got sick. And, you know, it's real crazy when you look back and you think that each time I went out, I thought it was going to be different. It's going to be different this time. But it never was. And I wanted just to impress you. And it's awful hard to do that when you go out and get sick and throw up on people, you know. They're not too impressed. And why I couldn't think of this, I don't know. But like I say, shortly before coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a physical examination because I hadn't had one in many years, and all the girls at work were getting them and saying, you got to, you might have cancer and all this kind of stuff. And so I went and had this physical, and the doctor told me I was anemic. And I was delighted because I thought, jeepers, that's why I can't drink. Because I couldn't figure out why I couldn't drink like other people. And I thought, that's the reason. You know, anybody with a weak stomach and thin blood sure can't drink. And so the doctor gave me a diet and to eat all of these things that were great blood builders. And then he gave me an unrestricted diet. And on this diet, there was a list of about 30 things. But the one thing I remember was wine, because he said this was very good for the blood. And so, of course, being very concerned about my health, I started drinking wine. And, you know, I'm sure I must have had the greatest blood in town. But, gee, I really tore the rest of the little pink body down, because I really got sick, where I couldn't even drink water. And I'm sure that this doctor helped me into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it was shortly after this that I came to you people. Many things, like I said, happened when I drank, and many things that were funny, and many things that I was very embarrassed about and felt shame and guilt about, and if I could have changed them, wished I could. And the last drunk that I had was not actually my real worst drunk. I had started, you know, of course, sneaking drinks whenever I went any place, going to the kitchen and sneaking and everything. And I remember at a meeting after I came into the program, they were talking about when you cross over the line, you know, from the social to the alcoholic drinker, and a gal said it's when you stop bragging about how much you drink and start lying about it. And I thought, you know, that's really true, because when I first started drinking, I used to brag about how much I could drink, you know, and then later it was always just had two, you know, or something, just had a couple drinks. And but my last drunk, it'll be 8 years this December, and it was Christmas Day. And Christmas, I had two roommates, and they were school teachers, and they had gone home for the holidays, and I was out with my parents. And we had gone next door on Christmas Eve for eggnog. And I went over with my parents and was in a blackout shortly after we got there. And I don't remember anything about it. And, of course, the next morning I woke up, and I didn't remember coming home or anything else. And of course, the remorse and the guilt and all this set in again. And I didn't want anybody to know, but my mother talked to me and didn't say anything about it, so I must have acted all right, because many times I could be in a blackout and, you know, walk and talk all right. And so I decided that I wasn't going to drink Christmas, because I knew by this time I couldn't guarantee my conduct when I drank. And I didn't want to perform again for my family. And so I made up my mind I wouldn't drink, because my brothers, some of my brothers and their wives and families were coming over, and even some of my sister-in-law's parents and neighbors, and they were having this real family get-together. And because I didn't want to perform, I decided I would not drink. And I didn't until 6 o'clock. And this is when we were setting the food out on the table, and I knew that it would be all right to have a drink now, because after all, we're going to eat immediately. And so I had my, went out and had a drink of scotch on the rocks, and I always had a twist in everything, because somebody told me that it prevented scurvy, you know. So everything I had to use a twist. And so I had this drink, and I was in a blackout before I finished it. That's how progressive this illness was with me. And, of course, I performed. I fought for drinks. I performed for the family. And I did many things. But I don't remember anything until 3 o'clock the next morning when I woke up. And you know that feeling when you wake up and it's not daylight and you can't go back to sleep and it's too early to get up and you want to die. And you try to think of what you did or who you hurt or what you said. And I just prayed the floor would swallow me up, because, you see, I didn't want to face anybody. I didn't want to face my family. I didn't ever want to see him again, because, you see, I didn't want to find out. And I just laid there with all this guilt and the self-pity and the remorse and why me and contemplating suicide. And I finally, my mother's an early riser, and she got up and I met her in the hall. And she looked at me with that look that every alcoholic has seen in the eyes of someone that loves them. You know, that desperation that they look at you with that hollow, empty look in their eyes, and those words that we've all heard, they look at you and say, "Why do you drink so much? I was so ashamed of you." And God, I couldn't stand it. Couldn't stand the look in her eye, and I had to look down because, you know, I wish I could have stood there and said, "Gee, Mom, you don't know. You know, the reason I drink like this is because I hurt inside, and I feel inferior, and I feel insecure. And, oh, I got that God-awful loneliness in here. This is the reason I do it." But you see, I didn't know that then, because I hadn't been to you people yet. The only thing I could do is give her that same old answer and say, "I don't know," and look at the floor. Well, I told her that my roommates were coming back. I had things I had to do, and I had to get home. And so I drove home, and I went in my room and laid across the bed crying with all the remorse and self-pity and wanting to know, why me? You know, this wasn't my goal in life. I hadn't set out to do this. And I'd tried everything not to get drunk. And why was this happening to me? I was really a pretty good kid, you know. If people only knew what I really meant, what my ideas in here were to be. But no matter what I went out and what my intentions in here were, it always ended up different, the way that I didn't want it to be. And so, as I was laying there in this self-pity, I finally said, you know, to God, "Why do you leave me here? Why on earth did you put me here? Because I'm certainly no good to anybody. And I'm certainly not needed, and the world and everyone would be better off without me. And if there's anything you have for me to do in this lifetime, I wish you would please show me. Because whatever it is that you put me here for, I know I'm not doing it. And I just don't have anywhere to go, and I don't know what to do. And if there's anything that you have for me, please show me." And of course, it was at this time that I thought of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I had a girlfriend that had joined AA, and, but I had this girlfriend, and she had joined AA, and so I called her. And, of course, by this time, it's about 8 o'clock in the morning, the day after Christmas, you know, and I'm on the phone. And I called her and told her that I wanted to see what she got for Christmas. And so she, like, I guess, was pretty shocked. And I said that I wanted to come over and visit. She had joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and then she had recently married, and she had just had a baby. And she just lived a few blocks from me. And so I said I wanted to come and see what she got for Christmas, and she said, well, okay, that I couldn't come over till 1 o'clock. And I'll tell you, that was the longest morning I ever put in, because I just kept looking at the clock, waiting for time to go. And I didn't think it'd ever get there. But I think she used this time to set out the word to all these AAs I was coming, because I didn't anymore get there at 1 o'clock till there's somebody at the door, and it's a couple on AA. And they came in and just talked about AA and Alcoholics Anonymous and all these kind of things, and I just went to visit. I was just her friend, you know. And I'll never forget this fellow, because he said, "Do you know," he says, "that every time you have a blackout, you have brain damage." You know, now I didn't know what a blackout was, but I was all ears. And I thought at the time, I thought, ziggity. You know, I was never the brightest thing in the world, you know. I had plenty of problems, you know, at work and in school and everything without all this brain damage stuff. And so, boy, I really listened. And then they didn't any more than leave till another gal came by. And she was AA, and she was talking about all these things. So finally, after they all left, I asked her my question that I went there for. And I said, "Patty," I said, "I'd like to know what I can drink so I won't get drunk." And she said, 7-Up. And, you know, I think of all the things I tried, but I never tried not drinking, you know. I tried all this olive oil, half and half, and all these things, but never one time did I think of not drinking. And so then we talked a little while, and she said maybe I'd like to go to a meeting with her. So I thought I would go as a visitor, just to a meeting because I surely was an alcoholic. Because, you know, my connotations of an alcoholic were entirely different. And I said, well, that I'd go to a meeting because New Year's Eve was coming up and I wanted to know what you people did out there. And I thought I could get some good ideas because I thought, you know, that the only thing you did in AA was, tell you how to act out there with the drinking people and out amongst all the drinkers, where they didn't know that you weren't drinking or how you acted. And I thought you carried little martini glasses around with an olive and water, you know, and everything and all this kind of stuff. Because I couldn't imagine, not drinking, or, you know, going to Alcoholics Anonymous or anything like that. So, anyway, I went to my first meeting and we walked in the door and there are my next door neighbors to my folks. And, of course, I was a visitor, so I thought it was all right, you know. But, of course, they were members of the fellowship. And so I went up, and there was a real big room. There was probably 125 people at this meeting on Friday night. And she took me up in the second row, and it was a speaker night. And so then they asked for newcomers. And so I turned around because I wanted to see what they looked like, you know. And I turned around to look because they always ask for them and have them stand. And just at the time I'm turned around looking, well, she reaches over and grabs me by the shoulder and pulls me up. And then she says, this is Dottie, and it's her first meeting. I almost died. I told her I was just a visitor, you know, and everything. But after the meeting was over, so many of the people came up and shook my hands, and they were so friendly and so nice, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being there. But the only thing was I thought, well, my life's over. You know, I had a chance and I goofed it. Because I knew that, you know, I would never date again. Because I could just see somebody dating me. I could just see, you know, I thought, well, it's okay to come to Alcoholics Anonymous if you're married. You know, but if you're single, for heaven's sakes, nobody'd ever take you out. You know, I could just see saying, I'm an alcoholic. I could see him running, you know. And so I was going to be a martyr to this program. And thought, well, you know, my life's over and all the fun. I had my chance and I goofed it. So from now on, it's just nothing but go to meetings and never date and just this is it. And have you ever tried to be a martyr in AA? You know, it's just impossible because there's someone that's going to make you laugh and make you share and they care and you kind of walk hand in hand sharing and caring. And it's just impossible, you know, to be a martyr, to feel sorry for yourself for very long. And so I got real active in the program, and I started going to meetings, and I liked it because I was having a different kind of fun. I remember when I came in, I used to say, you know, but I had fun when I drank. And, you know, of course, to me then, I did because I had nothing to compare it with. As far as what was concerned then, it was the best fun I knew, you know. But today I know something different. My fun today is entirely different. So now I can look back and see. And so when I see him come in and say, but I had fun, God, I love him because I know how it felt, you know. And anyway, the things just got real good. They, at this one, the young people's meeting, they made me secretary. But like I said, I had this terrible giggling problem. And I just was, every time I was any place, I mean, it's just a miracle I'm in front of a podium. You just don't know. Because in my area, when I came in, they didn't let me get there. Because when they did, I couldn't do anything but stand up and say my name and giggle. I just get hysterical. And they made me secretary, but we have to read announcements. And I'd get up to read the announcements, and I'd say my name and start laughing and just get so hysterical. And then I'd start crying, and it was just awful. Somebody else would have to get up and read the announcements. So they made me treasurer. Because you don't have to talk. And because I had the type of sponsor that she would never, you know, if somebody said to get up there, she said, I had to get up. I mean, even she said, if you just say your name, but you got to get up there. So that's all I did. But when any outside group would come in or something and lead the meeting, they'd point to me to talk, they'd all just hold their breath, you know. And so I have improved a little. But like I say, I did get real active, and I went to a lot of meetings, and I started having a good time. And I had my ups and my downs, and one day, you know, I'd say, boy, this program, I just don't see how anybody can work this program. Oh, I mean to tell you, it is so hard, and oh, and you know. And then maybe a couple days later, This is the most wonderful program. I don't see how anybody can't work this marvelous program. You know, and all these things, I would just either up or down. You know, I couldn't hit an even keel. But then, of course, as time progressed, and I had the type of sponsor, too, that whenever I had a problem or I told her whatever it was, my car, my job, or whatever it was, she'd say, start writing, you know. And I'd say, you know, it's not going to do any good to write an inventory about something that happened before. You know, how's that going to straighten out my boss or my finances or anything like this? And she'd say, well, start writing. And so I got this little paper and pencil, little secretary's notebook, and I started writing things. And I'd write them in code system because I didn't want my roommate to get a hold of it. And then I'd hide it under my mattress. Then I'd go along for a while, and something else would come up, and she'd say, you got to keep writing. So then I'd write a little more. And this is the way I wrote my inventory in parts. Now, this is the fifth step is something that I said I would never take because it would not be necessary for me. Because after all, I was single and I didn't have a family to do all these things to and all this kind of stuff. So it wouldn't be necessary for me to do this fourth and fifth. But, you know, I believe if you come to this program and are willing, that you will do things that you never dreamed you would. And they will, at the time, they'll just happen through no effort of yours. Because it's the way it happened with me. And I was in my office one day, and it just came to me that I had to take my fifth step because by this time I had all my fourth written. And I started calling retreat houses in the area because I wanted to get away. I still lived with these same two roommates, and there was never much quiet time or peace and quiet over the weekend or any place where I could really be alone. And so I wanted to be alone to rewrite my fourth and take my fifth step. So I started calling retreat houses in the area. And I found one that had a woman's retreat and had an opening that weekend. And I said, I'll be there. And I got in my little car and off I went. And I took all my notes with me. And I completed from my notes and from a little outline, I completed my fourth step and took my fifth step this weekend. And I felt so good. Because I'd taken it. Because it's something that I said I would never do. And that's the one step, that fifth step was the one step that scared me more than any of the others. And it's the one I said that wouldn't be necessary for me. And I had done it. I had actually done it. I thought, boy, the others are going to be a breeze, you know, compared to getting this one done. But it was like the way things were after this. It was like, you know, before, it was like I had a fishbowl over my head. With all of these neat things you people were telling me, first things first, easy does it, let go and let God, and all of these things. And it's like I had them here in this fishbowl. But you see, they didn't have any room to come down and be in here. They were only head knowledge. And it wasn't until I completed my fourth and my fifth step that I cleaned out all of this, all of that guilt and the remorse and the inferiority and the insecurity. And the loneliness, all of these things. Not until I cleared them out that I had room for all of these things you people taught me to come down and be heart knowledge rather than head knowledge. And then I'd go along and somebody'd say something, say, that's it. You know, like I'd made the great discovery. And I'd heard it many times before, but it wasn't mine in here. And, you know, at this time is when it freed that little feeling that we all have inside, the spirit or the intuition, whichever you wish to call it. But it's that little feeling that we all have inside that when you do something, you know, that's unkind or you say an unkind word or you hurt somebody, you know how you just feel wormy all over. You know, you just don't feel so good. But it's also that same little feeling in there that when you do something kind or the smile and the handshake to someone that's hurting or that phone call or something that you just feel good all over, you know, you just feel goosebumpy and feel so good. That's what it is, that little feeling. And as long as I keep all of this stuff cleared out and let that tell me and guide me, I'm in pretty good shape. But, you know, a lot of times I don't listen. I'll say, oh, you know, that's not really, you know, and I'll barrel ahead. But as long as I keep that free, I go along pretty good. And, of course, after this, things kept getting better and better. And working on the character defects and all of these things and continuing on the program and trying to work the other steps and tried to continue the prayer and meditation and all of these things, it just kept gradual. It was a very gradual thing for me that things just kind of would get a little brighter. But I still was kind of like a third wheel every place. You know, it was always like five couples and Dottie. You know, three couples and Dottie. 10 couples and Dottie. It was always like I was a third wheel. And I used to try and bargain sometimes with God, and I'd say, but God, can't you see? You know, I mean, if you just, you know, if I just didn't have to do all these things and go all these places by myself, you know. And people say, in God's time, you know, and everything. I was sober for 4.5 years on this program, and I was 34.5 years old when I got married. And, of course, I married Johnny that spoke last night. And, as you know, Johnny was a widower, and he had these two children. And I had never been married. I was a career girl. So, you know, I think that we all have these ideas of what it's going to be like. And I'd forgotten many things that you people taught me in AA. I just had this storybook idea. You know, I could just see him coming home from work and the lovely dinner and the children in their little crispy dresses and we meet him at the door and all this, you know. And it's not like that, you know. It was wild. You've never seen such chaos. Because, you know, I was going to make up for everything these little girls had missed since their mother died. And I was going to be the perfect wife and the perfect mother. It would just decide. And I was going to be the perfect wife and the perfect mother. It was just something else. Because, well, the little Jackie, she was 4 when she lost her mother. And she was 6 when I married her father. Now, the oldest one, Karen, she was 8 when she lost her mother. And she was almost 10 when I married her father. And it was much harder for her to adjust. And, of course, I wanted to be perfect. And when we went on our honeymoon, we came back and the apartment was not available till after we were married, so I couldn't get anything put away or shelves lined or anything before. And my dad and my mother moved my things in, and one of my brothers moved Johnny's things in and the girls and stuff. And so when we came back, everything was just sitting in boxes, you know, all over. And then he went to work, and I have my 2 little girls, and 1 on each side, you know. And here I am, nothing, not a shelf line, nothing put away, just boxes. It was just chaos, you know. The time I'd be in the middle of something, they'd say, I'm hungry. I'd say, oh, that's right, you know. And everything, I have to stop and go do something. And I'd be down on the floor in the cupboards lining shelves, and he'd walk in and I'd say, are you home already? You know, and it was just while we were in this area, the girls didn't know anyone in the area because it was new to them. And it was summertime, and so there I had my 2 shadows. And the youngest one whined all the time. And she would say, my mommy, my mommy, my mommy. And she hung on me constantly. And the oldest one, she was kind enough to point out everything I did wrong. And she would say to me, that's not the way my other mother did it, you know. And things like, my other mother was prettier than you, too. The little one said to me, she says, you know, my favorite thing to eat before I started living with you used to be spaghetti. She says, but you know how you get it hard on the sides? Or she'd ask me, what's the difference between burnt and scorched? I'll tell you, everything was new for me, and I wasn't used to cooking and doing all these things, and everything was a new decision. And even going to the market, you know, what do kids eat? You know, what do you cook? And everything. And then, of course, at the wedding, some of the wedding gifts and things, where I had duplicates, and I had just a certain time to take those back, so I'm trying to make gift exchanges, and I'm trying to write thank you notes, and I'm trying to move in, and I'm trying to be a mother and a wife and all of these things, and I just forgot everything, you know. And we were going one day into this store and taking some of these exchanges back, and I had gotten several salad bowls, and so when the woman asked me why I was returning it, I said, you know, it's a duplicate, I have another one. And the little one says, you know, because it was a different color. But, you know, all of these things we were doing, it was just something else. But we somehow survived. But You know, I didn't want to hurt their feelings. And I my ego became involved. And I didn't want them, you know, and the people in AA and all these people to think I was an evil stepmother, you know, these ideas you think of. And so I wasn't going to be one of those people that hollered at my kids or anything. And so we'd be in the kitchen, or I'd be cooking dinner, and they'd be one on each side, and I have to say, oh, pardon me, dear, excuse me, pardon me. You know, many times I want to say, get out of the kitchen, you know, but I couldn't. I might hurt their feelings, or they may not like me, or I might be a mean stepmother, or what if they told someone I hollered, and all of these things, you know. So here I am trying to be this sweet, wonderful, perfect thing, you know. And then I got this ulcer. I thought I was getting an ulcer. I got the flu. I couldn't get over it. Oh, I just, you know. And finally, one day, I was in the kitchen cooking, and they were in there. They were always in there. And she said, they had a balloon, and I had the electric skillet, and the balloon popped right in my ear. And, of course, by this time, you know, I'm like this. And the balloon popped, and I jumped and came almost, and dropped the skillet, and I came out, and I screamed, get out of this kitchen. And I'm telling you, Johnny was already home from work, and they all looked at me. I said, you know... And finally they said, what's wrong with Mommy? And he said, I don't know, she must have had a bad day. You know, and I thought to myself, what's wrong? It's them. They're what's wrong, you know. And, but then in a few minutes, the realization came because I looked up and they're going, dee, 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 everything is fine, you know. And there I am, you know, like a worn out dish rag, you know. And I thought, you know, they're right. It is me. You know, because I'd forgotten. First things first. And I forgot what you people taught me, that I have to do what's best for Dottie. First. Because if I do what's best for Dottie, it's automatically best for everyone else. And you see, I'd forgotten that. And I had gotten away from my little quiet meditation time each day. Because, you see, the little one got up at 6 a.m. And, you know, it was summertime, so they didn't go to bed till late at night. And I thought I had to be the mother. You know, I mean, if they're up, you got to be down looking, at least looking like you're doing something, you know. And so I was always just so exhausted. And at the time that I was going through all this, I had a friend I worked with, and she says, how do you like not working? Yeah, I said, yeah. I thought, I never worked so hard in my life. What do you mean? But I finally thought that, you know, that's right. I had forgotten all of these things. And at the time... then I went back to, and got my little book out that I liked to read and that I liked for my meditation. And as I, you know how you always open the right thing at the right time, and I opened it up, and it was talking about let go and let God. And it said in there, it said, what did God say when he made the world? It was let there be light. Not make there be light, but let. And I didn't realize the importance of that little word. Because, you see, I was trying to make things happen. I was going to see that these girls were never unhappy in their entire life, you know. And I was going to see that all of these things. And I was forgetting to just do the best I could, which you people taught me. That the only thing I can do is the best I can each day and leave the results to God. But I'd forgotten that. I was trying to make it happen. And in the big book, it says lack of power. Was our dilemma. And you know, lack of power is my dilemma today. It was my dilemma before, and it is still today. But God working through me to the children, or through you to me, you see, and it works. But see, I didn't have that power before. And the only time I have it now is I don't have it, but God does. And so this is when I have to let go and let God. And I thought, gee, that's right. And so I had to start taking my time for Dottie. And for some reason, they shaped up, you know. They just shaped up. And, you know, this thing had happened. I finally had to come to the realization that I had to be a mother. You know, I had to act like one. Not some sort of fairy godmother floating through life, you know. And so I had to set down the laws. I had a talk with Johnny, and we set up the... situation, and I told him, you know, because the kids were driving me as far as they could, getting by with anything they could, and so we set down house rules, and I finally had to have a talk with him, and I said, you know, that I'm not here for a personality contest. Evidently, God thought that we could share something together in our life, and this is why I'm here. And I told them that I was the boss when their father wasn't home. And whatever I said for them to do, they would do, whether I was right or wrong. I said, I'm a human being and many times I will be wrong. But even when I'm wrong, I'm boss and you're going to do it. And they were a little shocked. And we set down a list. There were three definite no-nos that they could not do. And by 7 o'clock the next morning, they'd done all three. And Johnny was gone to work. And there I was, faced with this. And I just looked at him. I said, you didn't. I said, oh, please, you didn't. You know. And I had to either, you know, follow through or forget it. And so I had to give them their first spanking. And I'd never spanked a kid in my life. I was a nice little aunt that took all my nieces and nephews to the circus and all these little things, you know, but I'd never spanked a child. And so I told them to go get in position. And and so I got out this little paddle, and I went in and gave them each couple swats. And I went back to my room and cried, and I was just shaking so hard. And I heard him in the bathroom a little later, and I heard one of them say to the other, gee, you can tell Mommy loves us because she spanks us. Isn't it amazing? The things that I have learned from these children and from you people. I am just so grateful because I have had many, many more joys from this than I ever have in the problem adjusting area. Once I was able to get Dottie straightened out in the situation and come back to the program and the very simple things you people taught me, I was able to function. And they were able to function. And we really have a beautiful life today because I don't know of anything better than being married to another member of this program or the Al-Anon program and sharing this program with one another. Because my husband allows me the freedom to be wrong. And I usually am, you know. But he allows me this freedom, and he lets me say my piece, whatever it may be, and he listens. And then he'll say, are you through? And I'll say yes, and then he'll say something so sweet or something, he'll explain it, and then I feel like a big jerk, you know. I've yet to be right, you know, but I'm the blabbermouth. But it's just beautiful. And I'm just so grateful for all of the things that you people have taught me because you gave me this family. You know, when I was first trying to talk with the girls, it was very difficult. I remember, like I said, the little one, she always whined and cried all the time and to get the attention and everything. And so I used to say to her, Jackie, you've got to think more positive. And she'd say, what's positive? You know? And I'd say, well, don't be so negative. And she'd say, what's negative? You know, and then I'd try to explain and say, we got to have happy thoughts and all of these things. And, you know, sometimes you wonder if it, you know, if it ever gets through to them. But I was taking them to swimming lessons with the little neighbor kids. And this is when Jackie was 7, and I was taking them over to swimming. And on the way home and back to the car, I heard Jackie tell him this other little 7-year-old, little Kelly. She said that she only got in the water one time that day because there was a little boy in her class that was afraid of the water. And so the instructor worked with her all the time, with this little boy all the time. And she says, and you know, she said, if that little boy doesn't change his attitude and stop thinking so negative and be more positive, he'll never learn to swim. You know, I got so tickled, you know, because I don't know if Kelly knew what she was talking about. But it really does rub off. But, you know, another little trick I had to try when I was going through this and that you people taught me is it was so hard. People would say, turn it over. I remember when I came in, you know, something's wrong, they'd say, turn it over. And I think, how do you turn it over? I did. I said, take it. You know, but then I'm still thinking, plan X may work, you know, or something. You know, so I really hadn't turned it over because it couldn't get down in my mind. And so I had to play little tricks on myself. So I got a little paper sack. And I write on the outside of this little paper sack, God's bag. And then I write whatever my problem is, whatever's bugging me or the obsession or whatever it is that can't get off my mind or I'm worrying about or trying to figure out how the outcome is going to be. And I write that little problem on a piece of paper and I stick it in the bag. Now, as long as that little piece of paper is in the God bag, that means I've given it to God and I can't think about it. Because if I want to think about it, I've got to take the little paper out of the bag and hold it. And you feel kind of silly sitting there holding a little piece of paper, you know, thinking that you can do better than God. And I'll tell you, this really worked for me. And because I just put it in there, and every time they come to mind, I'd say, oh, it's a beautiful day. You know, I'd try anything not to think of it. And now my kids have a God bag. And one day Karen came home from school, and she says she was having some kind of problem at school, and she says, oh, but I just put them in my God bag, you know. So some of these things do happen. And another thing that you people taught me when I came in was about resentment. Now, I'd never heard of this before. I mean, you know, or you never talk about it. Oh, you have a resentment. You never hear that out there, you know. But in here you do. And I remember when I was working, and my boss, it was the day we got W-2 forms, supposed to be, and I asked my boss when we got them, and he said, as soon as you make them out. And I said, but I've never done that before. And he said, well, you read that tax book and make them out, and they have to be mailed by midnight tonight. And he went to play golf. And I remember I was so upset. I just was so mad. I couldn't read that textbook. I couldn't figure out anything, and I was trying to do all of these things. And I finally called this girlfriend of mine on the program, and her husband's also alcoholic, but she wasn't home, and he was. And I told him about this terrible thing that they were doing to me. And he listened for a while, and he said, gee, it sounds like you got a big fat resentment. You know, and I said, oh, you know. And he said, I want to ask you one question, Dottie. He said, who's hurting? I said, I am. He said, that's right. He said, do you think you getting all steamed up and all upset is going to affect his golf game? And I said, no. And he said, well, you can do one of two things. You can lock up the office and never go back. He said, or you can read that book and do the best you can, and if they're wrong, it's his problem. And I thought, I'm not going to let him do this to me, you know, get me upset. But, you know, I had to come to you people to find out that if I have a resentment or I'm all upset with someone else, that the only one that hurts is me. And you people have taught me to learn to love Dottie. And so because you've taught me how to learn to love me, I don't like to hurt me anymore. So I try when these things come up, I try to not hurt because I know that I'm the only one that can hurt me, that you can't, but I can. And you people taught, where else in the world could you go and be able to pick up a phone and call somebody and have them tell you the truth? It has just been so beautiful this weekend to be with you people. And I'm just so grateful to every one of you because I do love you. Because you've shown us such a warm and wonderful weekend. And you see, my husband usually goes, travels quite a bit to some of these things, and you're the first people that ever let me come, too. And that's real good. And by the time I got the dogs and the kids and everyone taken care of and packed and baby sat and dog sat and everything, it's just been wonderful. And see, everybody's just been so great. I just can't tell you. You people are so warm and open-hearted. You know, it's like any meeting of AA, you go in and you can just feel it. You know, it would be like going to the ocean and you try to take out all the water. You can take as much back as you have the container. You can fill up the container as much as you can possibly fill, and you can take that, and there's still plenty left for everyone else. And so I'm telling you, I'm sure going to fill up my vessel today and take back the love and friendship of AA that you people have shown me here in Oregon. And I want to tell you one little thing about the miracle of this program and our daughters, because one night not too long ago we were sitting across the dinner table, and the little girl Jackie, she looked up at me and she says, Mommy, you know, you're the best mommy I ever had. And you know, the only thing I could do was cry and say, thank you, AA, thank you, God, thank you, alcoholic, because if I weren't an alcoholic, you know, I'd have missed all this. I'd have missed it. And I'm just so grateful to you all, and thank you so much for letting me be here today.